I'm anxious to just look them in the eye and see how they feel about destroying so many people's lives.
The trial for a couple accused of starting the 2015 Mat-Su fire gets underway in Palmer. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the oil and gas industry defends Hillcorp's safety record after several incidents in Cook Inlet.
It makes no sense to say, oh, well, just because we had a leak over here means they will never be able to respond to a leak in the Arctic.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Did an Anchorage couple start the 2015 wildfire that devastated part of the Mat-Su? That's the question for a Palmer jury, which heard opening statements today as a trial over what became known as the Sockeye Fire began. Prosecutors and state fire investigators say Greg Immig and Amy DeWitt are to blame. But defense attorneys for the husband and wife told jurors this morning that their own experts can prove otherwise. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove was there and has more.
In the matter of a few days, the Sockeye Fire charred thousands of acres and dozens of homes in Willow, a community of many Alaska dog mushers. The fire forced mandatory evacuations and killed pets and sled dogs as it exploded through the valley during dry, windy days starting June 14th. Investigators say they tracked the massive blaze back to smoldering embers from an illegal brush fire that Immig and DeWitt set after clearing land on their Willow property. Standing outside the courtroom just before the trial started, veteran Iditarod musher Dee Dee Johnro fought back tears and said it had been a long 2-year wait to see them in court.
I'm anxious to just look them in the eye and see how they feel about destroying so many people's lives. We lost everything we've ever owned in the last all of our lives. We lost our house. Our 2-story house was turned into 3 inches of ash and an 8-foot hole in the ground.
Inside the courtroom, several other victims sat in the front row with Johnro as the trial began, with opening statements from each side. Prosecutor Eric Senta described to the jury how evidence and testimony will show the fire crept away from the illegal burn pit through what are called microfuels, tiny dry dead leaves and sticks on the ground.
Slowly at first, but getting stronger and stronger as it spread further into the dense woods. After several feet of traveling in the small dead leaves and twigs, the fire grew hot enough to catch the branches of one of those bone dry white spruce trees. And that tree went up like last year's dead Christmas tree.
Senta says that is when, after calling 911, the couple and their son fled in an RV and drove home to Anchorage. All the while, Senta says, firefighters and Good Samaritans rushed to evacuate people in the growing fire's path, including some who had to run for their lives. When it was the defense's turn to lay out their case, attorney Kevin Fitzgerald told the jury that the prosecutor's theory defied common sense. Fitzgerald says the husband and wife admit they did not have a burn permit that day. Permits had in fact been suspended, but they saw the fire well after it had started coming toward them from someone else's land. And the family alleges they fled because 911 dispatchers told them to evacuate. Fitzgerald says the defense's expert witness will show the fire investigators' work should have been deemed inconclusive and that they were wrong about the burn pit.
But he will tell you affirmatively that this pit was not the cause of the Sockeye fire.
The trial's expected to continue for weeks. Senta, the prosecutor, began calling firefighters to the witness stand today after opening statements. In Palmer, I'm Casey Grove.
The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation today announced that a leaking oil and gas well on the North Slope was successfully plugged. The well, owned by BP, began spewing oil and gas last Friday. The spray of crude oil was halted on Saturday, but it took responders until early Monday morning to curb the flow of gas by pumping salt water down the hole. A mechanical plug was installed yesterday. The state still doesn't know what caused the leak or how much oil was spilled, but the state reports observations from 2 overflights indicate the crude oil spray did not reach the nearby tundra. Last week, Hillcorp was finally able to fix a fuel line in Cook Inlet that regulators say started leaking gas in December. But the oil and gas company and its allies are still struggling to contain another issue, environmental groups, which argue that Hillcorp's problems in Cook Inlet disqualify the company from drilling for oil in the Arctic Ocean. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk explains.
Earlier this month, Lois Epstein wrote an op-ed in the Alaska Dispatch News. Epstein's headline read, "Hillcorp's Cook Inlet Leaks Underscore Arctic Risks."
I certainly have, and I know others have, enormous concerns about Hillcorp being the operator of this new operation in the Arctic, because it's a company that doesn't appear to have a strong handle on its operations.
Epstein works for the Wilderness Society. She notes that Hillcorp's gas leak in Cook Inlet took months to fix, as dangerous ice conditions prevented divers from getting to the pipeline. The company also had to shut down two other pipelines in the inlet this spring due to suspected leaks. Epstein says the incidents raise questions about a project the company is pursuing hundreds of miles to the north. Hillcorp is moving ahead with the only offshore drilling project currently planned in federal Arctic waters. It's called Liberty. Hillcorp wants to build a gravel island in shallow waters about 6 miles from the Beaufort Sea coast. The drilled oil would float ashore via a buried subsea pipeline. Epstein argues that Hillcorp's gas leak in Cook Inlet was hard to fix, and repairing a pipe or cleaning up an oil spill in Arctic waters would be a lot harder.
You do have lots of other challenges in the Arctic. You have storms, you have certainly cold, you have remoteness, you have the inability to respond very quickly because you don't have the people power and the infrastructure.
A growing number of national environmental groups agree with Epstein, including the Center for Biological Diversity and Greenpeace. They're calling for the federal government to scrutinize Hillcorp's safety records before approving the Liberty Project. And as President Donald Trump weighs an executive order to step back the Obama administration's moratorium on Arctic drilling, some groups even argue the gas leak shows oil development in the Arctic shouldn't happen at all. But the pushback from the oil industry has come hard and fast.
It's nonsensical. It makes no sense to say, oh, well, just because we had a leak over here means they will never be able to respond to a leak in the Arctic. It's just a fabrication.
That's Kara Moriarty of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, who wrote her own op-ed in the Alaska Dispatch News. It was just one of a wave of opinion pieces condemning environmental groups' arguments, which appeared in both local and national media. Moriarty argues recent incidents involving Hillcorp don't mean the company can't operate safely in the Arctic.
When something happens, the company responds, they change their behavior, they pay their fine, and they change their process. That's why you have regulatory oversight. It's not to say, oh, a company did something and we fined them and now they should never do anything else in Alaska again.
Hillcorp didn't agree to an interview for the story, but in an emailed statement, Hillcorp's David Wilkins said the Liberty Project is vastly different from its operations in Cook Inlet, but it is similar to two other projects Hillcorp is already operating in state waters in the Arctic. The Federal Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is currently working through the environmental review process for the Liberty Project. The agency expects to begin a 60-day public comment period this summer. And despite the oil industry's objections, environmental groups are sure to bring up the Cook Inlet gas leak when arguing Hillcorp has no business drilling in the Arctic. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a plan by the Juneau Bureau to annex land on Admiralty Island upsets people in Angoon.
Anything that happened on Admiralty Island is for the protection of the indigenous people of the island. It doesn't say anything about the city and borough of Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Families and community members on St. Lawrence Island will be eating bowhead whale this week after a local hunter caught Gamble's second whale of the season on Monday night. Chris Apasengok, a 16-year-old who would normally be spending his days in high school, was the hunter credited with catching the 57-foot-long female bowhead.
Chased it for maybe an hour and a half. The other boats could have got it, but they never got close enough to strike. And it came up right in front of us, and I struck it.
Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commissioner for Gamble, Edmund Apasengok, is Chris's uncle. He says the approximately 200-year-old whale was caught about 2 miles away from the village. But further out, there is significant open water around the island.
In the past, we have pulled our boats on ice and went to open water where there's whales. But now we can't do neither. You know, it's either too thin are too sick to go through or on its change. The winds move the ice more quickly and melts just as fast as soon as the wind picks up to 20-30 miles an hour.
Edmund Apasingak believes ice conditions like these have made hunting for whale more challenging over the last 5 years or so. Apasingak says the whaling season is going by quickly and bowheads are already starting to migrate. The city and borough of Juneau is looking to expand its boundaries on Admiralty Island. That island is home to Angoon, a community of about 500 people, some of whom fear a nearby land annexation would threaten their subsistence lifestyle. A meeting between Angoon and the city and borough of Juneau was supposed to take place this week, but was canceled at the last minute. KCAW's Emily Russell traveled to Angoon and has the story.
Albert Howard grew up in Angoon. He's served two terms as mayor, is now a member of the regional school board, and serves as vice president of the local tribe.
Pretty much lived here my whole life. I mean, I know one end of the island to the other because I've hunted it with my dad, and now I'm hunting it with my son.
And sometimes they don't see much on those hunting trips. So Howard says he talks to his son about the land and their rights to it. In the late 1970s, Admiralty Island became a national monument, in part because of its cultural significance. It's been inhabited by the Tlingit people for over 10,000 years.
Anything that happens on Admiralty Island is for the protection of the indigenous people of the island. It's in monument language and it's stated that way. You can find it online. It doesn't say anything about the city and borough of Juneau. I mean, that's pretty clear in the language.
Howard and others in Angoon, they're worried specifically about a place called Pack Creek. It's on Eastern Admiralty, about halfway between Angoon and Juneau. Pack Creek is a popular bear viewing place for tourists and hunting spot for locals. Howard says, though, he's worried that if part of Admiralty Island is annexed, its resources could be auctioned off.
This island belonged to the elders. I mean, the elders decided to keep it the way it is, and Pack Creek wouldn't be what it is if our elders decided to let everybody log it.
If land was annexed into the Juneau borough, that does not change land ownership.
Rory Watt is Juneau's city manager.
So on the example of Pack Creek, that would be in the Admiralty Island National Monument, you know, managed by the Forest Service. So even if we annex that, it would not become City of Juneau land. It would still be Forest Service under that management style.
And that Forest Service land in the Pack Creek area, it's protected from development since it's inside a national monument. So why would Juneau want to annex the land if it can't be logged or mined or commercially developed?
There's a lot of reasons. I mean, if you look at the state and the Constitution, I mean, the idea behind it is sooner or later the entire state ends up in a borough.
So basically incorporating it before anyone else does. Alaska's Constitution says the state must be divided into boroughs, either organized or unorganized. A study completed in the 1990s laid out possible borough models. Right now, though, most of Admiralty Island is considered an unorganized borough, and remote residents like it that way. Property owners in Funter Bay on the north end of the island wrote to the Juneau Assembly in February. They don't want to pay additional taxes or adhere to zoning regulations. Watts says there's no way of knowing how much property taxes this would bring to Juneau, since those properties have never been assessed. He says there are benefits to being part of the borough. Zoning, Watts says, makes sure the land is managed responsibly.
Well, we would say to Angoon or anybody else that had property in areas that we're looking at, we would be saying that we think there's an economic nexus or cultural nexus or recreation nexus between the areas we propose to annex in.
And Juneau representatives wanted to say that in person this week. Watt and other city officials had planned a trip to Angoon, but the mayor of Angoon, Harriet Silva, who declined to comment for the story, canceled the visit. Watt says it's still early on in the process. He hopes to reschedule a visit to Angoon and expects to host public meetings in Juneau in the coming months. Reporting in Angoon, I'm Emily Russell.
this fall, Kungiganak is set to install a lithium-ion battery in its utility system that could replace more than half the village's electric and heating needs with wind energy. For more than 4 years, about a third of the village's energy has come from this renewable resource. On Tuesday, a group called the Alaska Microgrid Partnership met in person for the first time and traveled to Kungiganak to look at this rare rural Alaska phenomenon and how it works up close.
Some communities don't have the capacity to keep those systems running or to operate them or even build them or refine them. And it was pretty clear today that Kungiganak surely has the capability to do that. They're very proud of what they have, and they're able to operate the system, and they're working to continue to improve it.
Dennis Miners leads Intelligent Energy Systems, the company that designed Kungiganak's wind system. His company is part of the Alaska Microgrid Partnership, a group that also includes National Energy Labs, the Department of Energy, the University of Alaska, and the Renewable Energy Alaska Project.
The goal is to define how far we can go with renewables, energy efficiency, and energy conservation together in reducing the use of fossil fuels, lowering energy costs, and creating jobs.
The Microgrid Partnership is designing models to post online that can be used by any rural Alaska community to reach these goals. They're using two communities to create the models, Chifornik, which they believe could run largely off wind, and Shungnak, which could do the same with solar energy. The project does not include funding to install these systems, but Chifornik has secured federal funding from another source and should receive 3 wind turbines by 2019. The Alaska Microgrid Partnership started last year and will end in September if federal funding isn't renewed. Lawyers representing the Delta Wind Farm are asking state regulators to deny a tariff filed by Golden Valley Electric Association that argues the utility should not be required to buy more power from the wind farm. It's the latest in a years-long dispute between the owner of the wind farm, who wants to expand his facility, and GVEA's board and management, who say the co-op can't integrate more wind power now without incurring costs that would be passed along to ratepayers. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
GVEA President and CEO Corey Borgeson says the utility's leadership turned down Delta Wind Farm owner Mike Kraft's offer to produce an additional 13.5 megawatts because Borgeson says it would cost ratepayers more money.
Right now, we are unable to accommodate any more wind power because of the significant cost of backing up wind.
Utilities must back up wind power with conventional sources to replace the power lost when winds die down. In GVEA's case, it's a couple of diesel-fired generators in North Pole that are kept idling and are throttled up quickly when needed. Borgeson says that inflicts a lot of wear and tear on the aging generators, and it increases Golden Valley's fuel costs by about 15%, or some $20 million, according to a recent GVEA study. So he says the offer was declined to keep those costs from showing up in ratepayers' monthly bills.
We told them that because of the significant cost of backing up their wind, that the financial harm to our members were too great, and we've been unable to purchase any of their power.
That's the basis of a tariff GVEA filed March 15th with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, or RCA, which explains why Golden Valley should be exempted from state and federal regulations and policies that require utilities to buy renewable power whenever possible. Kraft and his attorney, Teresa Klemmer, say GVEA has failed to make that case.
We think the assumptions that they use to kind of shoehorn that conclusion are totally without merit.
Klemmer and Kraft say Golden Valley's tariff is unlawful and, quote, riddled with outlandish assumptions and false statements. She argues in a 527-page response she filed with the RCA last week that the utility's leadership misinterprets and disregards state regulations that were established to help promote renewable energy sources such as wind.
It was, you know, really just a complete rejection of everything the regulations required.
Klemmer zeroes in on Golden Valley's claim that it can only use the older diesel-burning generators to back up the wind power that's being produced by the 2-megawatt facility that Kraft presently operates in Delta, along with GVEA's own 25-megawatt Eva Creek wind farm near Healy.
we just think they are misleading the public by trying to say that it's only the diesel-fired power that's going to be backing up the wind. It's just ridiculous.
Clemmer and Kraft argue that GVEA can back up intermittent wind power with facilities that burn, quote, reasonably priced power, such as coal. The RCA commissioners must rule on GVEA's tariff by May 1st. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Fairbanks police have released more information about an April 4th murder. 44-year-old Jose Alfonso Cifuentes Morales was found dead just after midnight on the road in the area of 3rd Avenue and Hall Street. No other information had been released until yesterday when Detective Peyton Meredith revealed cause of death.
An autopsy confirmed a couple days after the homicide that Mr. Cifuentes died as a result of a gunshot wound.
Detective Meredith also played a video of a person of interest in the homicide walking across a parking lot and asked for the public's help identifying him.
Surveillance video captured this unknown person that we're looking to identify walking with Mr. Cifuentes prior to the homicide. This video was captured from an undisclosed business on the Old Steese Highway. The individual appears to be wearing a jacket with a hood, a ball cap, and pants that have some sort of reflective striping on the bottom of both legs. The video has been forwarded to the FBI for enhancement.
Police have posted the video online, and Meredith encouraged the public to view it carefully.
If the person in this video looks familiar just from their height, their size, the way they walk, the clothes they were wearing, something about somebody was doing something peculiar the night of the 3rd into the morning of the 4th, or something somebody said after, and you think it could be the person in this video, please call 911, call the Fairbanks Police Department Investigations Division.
Meredith also shared an image of a white Chevrolet Impala sedan spotted in the area around the time of the murder. Police want to talk to the occupants of the car in case something they saw could aid the investigation. Detective Meredith thanked businesses that have provided surveillance video and requested anyone else with footage shot in the area of the murder to share it with police.
If you were driving around town as a private person with a GoPro going, filming stuff that night with a phone, please contact us. Let us look at your video. Don't rule it out yourself. Let us look at it to see if there's anything relevant on there or not.
Police Chief Eric Jukes says there's so far no known connection between the April 4th murder and that of another unsolved killing in which 35-year-old Carlos Lamar Battle was found dead at the Alaska Motor Inn this past Sunday. Unusually cold temperatures across the interior this week are slowing breakup. The National Weather Service reported a low of 4 below 0 Tuesday morning at Eagle, where longtime resident John Borg keeps an eye on the Yukon River.
With temperatures like we have now, there isn't much happening.
Records show a gradual trend over the last 100-plus years toward earlier breakups at Eagle. Last year, the ice went out on April 26, one of the earliest dates on record. But Borg anticipates a more normal early May timeframe this year, pointing to recent river ice thickness measurements.
The USGS has been in here, and they found ice anywhere from 4 feet to 5.5.
The 5.5-foot measurement is the third thickest ever recorded at Eagle, but Borg suspects it represents an atypical section of ice and says the other measurements are more in line with normal.
They're not unusual at all.
Borg says silt blown onto the river has helped melt overlying snow, but it's going to take warmer weather to thin the ice.
You got to have warm days of the water pooling up and soaking in and beginning to honeycomb the ice so it deteriorates to a certain degree and assists in making the ice break a little easier.
Borg says there's still between 10 and 18 inches of snow on the ground in the area, a late season tally that could send a surge of water onto the river ice if there's an abrupt melt-off. That's what happened in 2009 when Eagle suffered a devastating ice jam-caused flood in early May. Civic engagement may sound pretty boring to some, but the eighth graders at Greening Middle School in Eagle River don't seem bored at all. They're competing in Project Citizen, a program that teaches students how to participate in local and state government, training politicians for the future. The state competition takes place in Fairbanks tomorrow. Alaska Public Media's Vikram Patel has the story.
The students at Greening aren't just doing a homework assignment. They're trying to solve an actual problem in their community. But before they can try to improve something, they have to figure out what it is they want to fix, according to their teacher, Tanya Shakoff.
We have students research what problems they think are important and affect our community and our society.
The classes chose to address a variety of issues, ranging in scope from the local to the global. And it's not just a theoretical project. Shakoff says the students decide what change they want to see and then try to actually make it happen.
They work through informing the level of government, whether it's a school board or a city council or state representatives, and have them petition for change or support them and their policy.
Project Citizen is a nationwide program run by the Center for Civic Education. It's designed to develop democratic values in middle schoolers, and in the process can also infuse students with the motivation to get involved. At Greening, one of Shakoff's classes chose to focus on curbing sexual assault because it's a particularly acute problem in Alaska. Eighth grader Abby Buchanan was shocked to learn that the state has the highest rate of sexual assault in the nation.
I mean, beforehand I thought this was like a nice, calm state, and then I found out about that fact and I was like, oh, that changes things around.
After researching the issue, Buchanan and her classmates wrote letters to the school board and the superintendent, reached out to the media, prepared a petition, and placed posters around their school, drawing attention to the issue. Over the course of the project, Buchanan figured out what her goal was.
I would like to see everyone feeling safer, like not being seeing women walking down the street, like I can see them carrying like keys in their hands as they're walking by themselves. I'm like, they should be able to feel safe walking to their car, to the grocery store at night without feeling afraid. That's what I'd like to see.
Buchanan and her class competed against 9 other Project Citizen teams at Greening, presenting their research and solutions to a panel of 3 judges. The top 5 scoring classes, including Buchanan's, advanced to the state championships in Fairbanks. From there, one team will win a chance to compete at the national championship. But Project Citizen has become about more than winning to these students. Here's Buchanan's classmate, Allison Heisley.
So we don't even have to get first place in competition. I just hope that it gets the attention that it needs.
Heisley is more worried about the big picture.
This is a scary topic that really needs to be focused on throughout our community, our state.
For Buchanan, the issue is now personal.
As 2 teenage girls living in Alaska and having such a topic that really revolves around, like, us, kind of, it really makes me determined to help not just only teenage girls, but like elderly women, young girls, all men, everyone who wants to feel safe here should be able to.
While Project Citizen is a useful teaching tool for middle school history teachers, it also appears to be at launching the careers of future activists and politicians. In Anchorage, I'm Vikram Patel.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Grove, Vikram Patel, and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Davis Hovey in Nome, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Emily Russell in Angoon, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.